41, HUR Voices, Washington.
Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM, Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight we're talking about advocating for your child who has a disability. Where do you go? What do you do? Where do you find help? My guests are Tana Jackson, Executive Director of Reagan's Voice, a child advocacy organization, and Dr. Sharifa Al-Ukta. She is an educational psychologist. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Terry, calling from Baltimore. Thanks for hanging on, Terry. What's on your mind?
Well, how you doing?
Doing just fine.
I was just calling to let you know that there's an agency in Washington, D.C. It's called Disability Rights Network. And under that umbrella, there's an agency in every state that's a nonprofit legal firm that provides services for individuals with disability. Like, I'm in Baltimore, so the one in Maryland, in Maryland is called Disability Rights Maryland. I used to work with the one in California called Disability Rights California. Like I said, they do a lot of special education work, Social Security. They provide accommodations and higher institutions of learning, which is college or some type of training school. And it's mandated by the federal government to provide these services for free.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Terry, thank you so much for that information. Ms. Jackson, you were nodding your head. You were familiar with it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I do think that there are definitely a lot of resources, and I do thank Terry for bringing that up. I think that it's also really kind of finding the match and the fit for what's really going on for the needs of your individual situation. I think that sometimes parents, you know, really like that one-on-one type of feel. So as Sharifa indicated, that, you know, having that component of an attorney or an advocate kind of brings that peace of sense of mind, that you regain your voice. But I do think that if parents can, you know, definitely find an organization that fits, you know, their perspective, I think that that's a great way to go.
Dr. Al-Ukta, let's talk a little bit about psychological evaluations. What should parents first do if they believe there is an issue with their child? When and what should they start looking for?
So one of the things that they may want to start looking for in children who are preschoolers really is their language development skills. How well do they play with peers? Older children, you want to look at more of the academic based behavior. So their writing, their reading, their mathematical abilities, as well as some of their frustration tolerance, their ability to, again, engage in what we call pro-social or appropriate peer and relationship behaviors. That's sort of the first thing that they may want to do. They may want to first consult with a professional that they trust. So their pediatrician, they may want to ask that question. If they do have a good relationship with their teacher, they may want to talk about some of the behaviors that they may see in the classroom, if it's similar. Once they sort of talk to the professionals and see if it's something that should be concerned or should go on to further testing, or if they just have in their gut that something isn't right, then they should engage in a psychological evaluation.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that, too. But let me go back to the phone lines, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Robert, calling from Maryland. Thanks for calling, Robert. What's on your mind?
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I have a student or a child with a disability in Prince George's County schools also. And I have to say my experience has so far been a pretty good experience. It seems like it's been pretty good. However, I'm starting to find there are deficiencies that are going on in my child's learning, and I'm finding that the school system isn't necessarily accommodating his needs or addressing some of the issues that he's dealing with. And I'm getting ready to go into his IEP meeting in about a week or so, and I was wondering, how should I approach it without necessarily being, adversarial? Because I know when you're adversarial, sometimes you know the school system shuts down. But I was just wondering if there were any ideas or anything that I could do to bring to the table.
Ms. Jackson.
I'm highly educated, But,
well, Robert, let me see if she can. Robert, let me see if she can try to address that issue, because it's an excellent question. Go right ahead.
Yes, absolutely, Robert. Great question. So I think one of the things that you can really do is to go in and one of the things that I did and even ask my clients to do is really create a notebook for yourself to kind of identify what are the salient points that you want to bring out about the deficiencies that maybe are not being recognized. And you as parent definitely have a perspective because you see, you know, your son every day and you're working with him. So I would encourage you to really go through the IEP to see the goals and objectives that they have for your son and then bring that up to the table. So you always come with your own set of agendas. And I think that, you know, coming in asking for what you want doesn't have to be adversarial. I think by stating the facts and the points about where you see the deficiency is lying and you have data to support that, i.e. looking at, you know, papers that you guys have done together, homework assignments that he's done, grades from tests and quizzes, and then really start to talk about the deficits that you see and see as if as a team you guys are able to collaborate to get what he needs. But I really would encourage you to gather yourself a notebook that identifies all of those areas and that so that you have a clear picture of what you're looking at. And when you're going in with data, because the school system uses data in order to best service your child. And you as the parent also need data to determine where you feel like the areas of deficiency is are.
Robert, thank you so much for your phone call. I appreciate it. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Pam calling from Pennsylvania. Pam, thanks for calling. Yeah. What's on your mind?
I have a question.
Sure.
A child who is now an adult. However, his disabilities have continued with him throughout his life, as they will. The situation is that he was not fully diagnosed until the end of sixth grade, therefore essentially lost the core basic years of learning, and the situation has continued to follow him. Any suggestions or recommendations as to what can be done now to help him?
How old is he, first of all?
And what's his disability?
He's 22. Okay.
And what's his disability?
He has ADHD. He has significant to severe auditory processing disorder. He has dysgraphia.
Okay.
And he has mood disorder, NOS, which I don't think they fully ever diagnosed and just gave him that diagnosis.
And for those who aren't familiar, because I'm not, dysgraphia, what is it?
Dysgraphia, I say dysgraphia is to writing as dyslexia is to reading.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's a writing
disorder. Dysgraphia is a writing disorder.
Like backwards.
Right.
Oh, really?
Dyslexia is reading it backwards.
Mm-hmm.
So he just writes backwards.
Interesting. Okay. So, Dr. Aukta?
So, have you considered getting him tested for Social Security disability? I think that
no.
I think that might be the first step, is to get him tested and to possibly get him on Social Security disability, and that way he can qualify for some of the adult disability services that Pennsylvania may offer. And so once children become adults, the legality and the services generally fall under the Social Security disability budget. And so that would be a way for you to be able to get him on the state insurance and be able to get him in the therapies and the programs that really address adult education in Pennsylvania.
I agree. I think definitely so. I think that would help you to kind of get a good basis and a handle on where things are. And the last time he probably was diagnosed, you know, is outdated information. So you just want to make sure as you're advocating for his needs that you're able to really pinpoint exactly what it is. So I totally agree.
Okay. Pam, thank
and
you.
Go ahead. For Social Security disability is fairly high. If he does not qualify for Social Security disability, are there any other suggestions or resources?
So for mental health to come through under the mental health, so I actually do Social Security disability evaluations, the threshold isn't as high as for medical disability. And because he already had a prior diagnosis, that is data that will be used to buffer his argument to be able to qualify for Social Security mental health disability. I'm seeing now in D.C. that students who are 18 and still in high school are getting their Social Security disability evaluations done in the school so they can be transferred. And it's a clear transfer that they don't lose the services that they already have in place in the school, that they're able to transfer and continue. And it's a sort of a wraparound care system. So I think that that is the first step, but it is going to continue to take the advocacy and the time. You may get denied first, but then you have to resubmit. And there again are legal advocates who help individuals through that process.
Okay. Well, Pam, thank you again for your phone call. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Madison calling from Maryland. Madison, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, how are you? Yes, so I just wanted to give some commentary as a former educator from Prince George's County. You know, it was really difficult. I was a math teacher, and I taught eighth grade, and I had students with IEPs, 504s. And honestly, they didn't even teach us as teachers how to implement this stuff. Mm-hmm. All we heard was, it's legal, you can go to jail for this, mm-hmm. document, you know, everything. And we had these kids, you know, even putting the students with disabilities aside. Mm-hmm. I had kids in my class that didn't know 4 times 4. Mm-hmm. They didn't know their multiplication factor. I'm trying to teach them algebra, introduce variables. It felt impossible. Mm-hmm. So in one period, I could see 36 students mm-hmm. in one period. The class could be co-taught, and that's co-taught means when you have your students with IEPs or 504s, and the co-teacher is off making copies, or they're using her in the building as a substitute for other teachers who aren't there. I mean, sometimes the state of the school, the state of the classroom is just chaotic. Absolutely. So as much as we wanted to help these kids, we couldn't. Sure. So honestly, you know, I was listening to the radio driving home, and I heard the woman call in about, you know, feeling like she was retaliated against for her daughter. Mm-hmm. I feel so deeply for her. Honestly, my heart breaks when I think about how many students walked out of my door without what they needed. Yep. But honestly, I felt like I didn't have what I needed to help them. We're all looking for the resources.
Madison, if I may, I want to bring Ms. Jackson back into this. That story is not a new story about parents feeling as if they are being retaliated against for their children. If that, for the sake of argument, if that is indeed happening, is that a defensive mechanism that school administrations use because they don't have the resources?
I definitely do. I think that the theory stands true. What you don't know can hurt you. So I think that sometimes, you know, I hear you, Madison, and I do feel for you having been in that space. I do think that, you know, sometimes school systems use the thing against the parents by them not really having enough information and knowing what they're talking about. For teachers and educators, it does become very difficult because you do find yourself sometimes in a situation where you just don't know how to support and advocate. But as far as the retaliation, I think that that's a real thing. And I think that when parents continue to educate themselves again about what their children need, it really helps to combat some of that retaliation because you have data, you have facts to prove that what you're asking for is not something that you're just making up. You know, it's based upon what your child needs and the importance of the school system really understanding that the infrastructure has been set up. There is things in place that says school and home should mirror. And when that doesn't happen, it is the responsibility of the parent to help engage the school and to reconnect them back to the purpose. Because at the end of the day, it is about the child and what they need, not what we need.
I need to take a break. Madison, thank you so much for sharing with us. We'll be back in just a moment. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Advocating for your child with disabilities. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We are continuing our conversation about advocating for your child who has a disability. Where do you go and what do you do about resources? Ms. Jackson, going back to the previous conversation about advocating, it seems to me that when you have individual parents such as Renee, whom we spoke to earlier, or Madison, whom we spoke to just a few minutes ago, that they need, there seems to me, there needs to be a movement and not just documenting and confronting. And obviously what you've done is part of a movement, but how do parents advocate for the masses when obviously resources are in short supply?
So I think that it's really kind of finding your niche in the struggle. So it's about connecting, you know, other parents that are like-minded. And as our organization, Reagan's Voice, our mantra is really, you know, educating parents so that they can go out and fight for their children. So I think it's one thing. It's great to have an advocate. It's great to have an attorney. But you are your child's greatest advocate. And so I think that to continue the movement, as you stated earlier, the documentation just kind of helps you to get there. And so it's really about inquiring about the things that your children need, but it's also educating yourself so that you know what's out there. So as you are gathering, as you said, this movement together, you're grabbing these people that think just like you and other parents that are going through the process. And I think that one of the biggest pieces that I know, even going through this as a parent myself, it's getting past that emotional state that's really difficult, because that's the real part. So after your child has been diagnosed and now you go through this process, you have entered into the world of special education, and it comes without a handbook. So not only are you dealing with the social emotional component of, you know, having this thought of my child's not normal, whatever that means, and now having to be faced with all of the legal ramifications that come with that, on top of just dealing with how do I give what is best for my child if I don't even know what that is. So I think it's continuing to educate yourself is how you start the movement. Knowledge is power. So you don't necessarily always have to have the financial resources and the things that you may see your other counterparts having, but if you can grab a hold to knowledge and grab other people that believe in that same vision and mission, I trust me, your one voice can bring us closer to change. You just have to make sure that you're articulating and that your voice is heard.
Dr. Aukta, let's talk a little bit about that knowledge. When a parent brings a child to you, I can only imagine the consternation and the discomfort that they feel. What is the process for the evaluation, the testing, and what do you tell parents before you get started?
So I tell them, one, that it may take a lot of time. It's not going to be a quick process, and that I'm going to need them to be an assistant in that process. And the more information that they give me, the better the data will be and the more accurate the results will be of the evaluation. And I'll let them know that there has to be multiple sources. So not only am I going to talk to them, I'm also going to have to talk to a teacher. I'm going to need as many records as possible. I let them know, I talk to them about what they think is the problem, because that helps me sort of structure which tests, which screening measures that I may use. There are some basic measures that are a part of most children's evaluations that include a measure of intellectual function and a measure of academic function. So intellectual function is broad thinking abilities, while academic functions are the specific school-based task. So that is generally a part of every psychological evaluation when testing. And then there may be specific screeners. So if there's an issue related to memory, an issue related to speech, an issue related to attention deficit disorder, there'll be specific screeners related to that. If there's more of an emotional concern, there might be depression or anxiety inventories. And so all of that will have to occur with the child. And so testing may occur over 2, 3, testing days specifically with the child. I may do a mother interview, a father interview, two teacher interviews. We try to get as many data points as possible to ensure that the diagnosis and the results of the testing are as accurate as possible.
But was that the case with Reagan?
Absolutely. So I totally agree with that process. I think that parents have to go in. And the other piece about that, too, is that you have to go in being honest. So it's letting all your defenses down and recognizing that the psychologist is there to help and they're there to do a job. But without all of the pertinent information that is really salient to them collaborating with you becomes very difficult. So I think it's like, I tell parents that we have to get her out of our own way. So it's recognizing that I'm going to be as open and honest as I possibly can because I want the best for my child, and holding back any information can skew the data. No fault to the psychologist, but just as a parent. So I think, you know, we have to also remember as parents that you have to trust those who are in positions to help. And that diagnosis will help you get started in this process because without it, it's difficult.
But why would a parent hold back information?
Out of fear.
And sometimes stigma. And stigma. I know you were like, oh, we got to do the PC, but the psychology.
Oh no, I was only talking about the name.
Yes,
that was my thing. I get the multisyllabic long term kind of, but every parent that has called has said they have a child with a disability.
They're advanced. When they come to me for the evaluation,
nothing is wrong.
They're not saying there's a disability.
I see.
They could have already had a conversation where someone may think that the child has a disability, and they will come in saying my child is just like everyone else, and we don't want this label. And so I have had to grow to say it's not a disability. This doesn't mean that your child is at any disadvantage from other children. It just means that you might have to work more, they might have to work more, which may be the case for a child who doesn't meet any of the qualifications that the IDEA has for an actual disability. Because they're advanced. Those parents are kudos to them. Like, because they're not using the term disability when they first come to my office.
Yeah, those parents are there and they know
Absolutely.
That their children need the special help and support and resources.
And I think that, you know, I do agree. I think that we are advanced. Like, I always share with parents that I liken it into a medical condition. If your child had asthma, and they needed an asthma pump, you would let everybody know that when they go to this playground, please make sure that they have their asthma pump, because if they have an asthma attack, you have to be able to address it. Well, education is no different. So some of our children will need an inhaler. And so as we get to the point of recognizing that if you inform everybody about what's going on, then it puts everybody on notice and it helps. But I do agree. I think that we have to, as a community, as a people, as a nation, really get to understand and move. My daughter is fully aware at 8 that these are the things that are going on. However, as a parent, I encourage her to understand that the disability is a part of you. It is not who you are. So I think if we help parents to understand that and give parents a sense of hope, I think it will change that mindset. Because I do believe that, you know, recognizing it brings forth change. Mm-hmm. And when you live in denial, it becomes very difficult to advocate for your child because you don't believe anything is wrong. And so therefore, the people who are there to help can't push any further than you will allow.
And you touched on something that I wanted to drill down just a little bit more about. Reagan is 8. And how do you believe she has been helped? She specifically, not you, because obviously you are completely empowered and engrossed in this. And certainly, you know, your daughter and the family is very fortunate to have, you know, the wherewithal, the intellectual chutzpah,
yes,
if I will, for you to jump in this with both feet. But as your child, as a mother, how do you think that what you've done with Reagan's voice and all of the advocacy has improved her quality of life?
I think that it's given Reagan a voice. To understand, like, she goes around now saying if she sees a child with a disability, mom, can we talk about Reagan's voice to them? Reagan is also at a school that promotes children with disabilities in the District of Columbia. She's at the Lab School of Washington, which has done a phenomenal job. Like, I also tip my hat off to them because they're doing great work for children with disabilities. So I think with that partnership between what we're doing at home and what's happening at school has given Reagan a platform. So she asked me at 8 years old to start looking at mom, can I learn about disabilities? You know, what is my disability specifically, and what are the things that we do, and how do we talk about this? And it's okay to learn different. So I think that the movement really starts within you as the parent, empowering your child to know that this is just a platform for greatness. And so once we get you the help that you need, it's their tool for life. Like they walk away with knowing that these are my challenges, but it doesn't mean that I can't accomplish. As was indicated earlier, it's not that, you know, it's to stifle them. It's to really help, because you're going to have to work a little harder. You are. And that's okay. You know, the race just has to be won. It doesn't have to be won fast.
Mm-hmm. Some final thoughts from you, Dr. Aogda.
I really liked your comment in regards to this needing to be a movement. Mm-hmm. And definitely the movement doesn't just need to include parents who have children with disabilities. We as a community need to move to improve our educational system to educate all of the children in the spectrum of learning and abilities. And I think that this is a very great topic, and I'm absolutely excited to learn more about Reagan's voice. And thank you for having us.
Yes, I've enjoyed my time with you.
I want to thank both Tana Jackson and Dr. Sharifa Aogda for talking with us. And as always, the website for Reagan'sVoice.org will be posted on WHUR.com before 8:30. So that you can find out more about the Parents Blueprint Workshop Series after the diagnosis. It's Saturday, November 12th from 1 to 4. Again, you can register online at reagansvoice.org, R-E-A-G-A-N-V-O-I-C-E. Ladies, thank you so much. I really appreciate
it. Absolutely. Thank you so much for having us.
That is The Daily Drum on Sirius XM, Channel 141 for this Thursday, November 3rd. I'm Harold Fisher. You can reach me on Facebook at Harold Fisher WHUR, on Twitter at H Fisher WHUR, or at Daily Drum WHUR. I'm off for the rest of the week. Bramante Bryant will be sitting in for me tomorrow, so listen in. Now, stay tuned for The Connection with Lorna Newton. Good night.
The Howard University Radio Network is WHUR 96.3 FM, WHUR World 96.3 FM.